have 17 and a half minutes now. My name is Joy Hall. I'm an alcoholic. My sober date is November 14th, 1991. And get ready. My home group is the Nuts and Bolts group in Lenexa, Kansas. And if that don't show you that I have satisfaction in my life today, I don't know what will. You know, I woke up, I was weepy, I'm grateful. I've totally screwed my diet this weekend. My feet hurt, but I have never been so satisfied in my life as a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous as I have been this weekend. And I am so, so grateful to a program that has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I know that sounds so cliche, but I'm not a person that's supposed to be here for numerous reasons. Yes, once I started drinking, I shouldn't be here because I should be dead, but I grew up normal. I was a normal kid. I didn't have any weird feelings. I was in a middle-class Catholic family, the oldest of three kids, had everything I could possibly want or need. All the love you could possibly imagine. I had a father who was my hero, who I grew up being told I could do anything I wanted, that I was good enough, that I was the best. And but yet I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, an absolute broken woman with a trash bag of clothes, complete shame, complete guilt, complete humiliation, and not a clue of how to fix any of that. And, you know, I'll just say a couple quick things to show you I belong here. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with four DUIs. The fourth one, I tried to outrun police in a Pinto. I had already had two kids without being married that I placed for adoption. I remember I was in spring break in Daytona Beach. I was in a blackout the whole time. I came home. Everybody had puka shells and I survived spring break t-shirts. I came home pregnant without a clue of how it happened. I put the baby up for adoption, went about my life. When I started drinking, I didn't even like drinking in the beginning. I didn't really like the taste of it. And I don't know what happened or when I crossed that line, but something changed for me. And all I wanted to do was feel no pain. All I wanted to do was numb out. And alcohol did that for me. I loved drinking, and I don't know why people apologize for that. Or, I mean, if we didn't like it, we wouldn't have AA. And I certainly, if I didn't like it, I would have gotten here faster. I don't know. Anyway, so I grew up in this Catholic family. I didn't even start drinking till I was almost 18 years old. And by the time I was almost 25, getting ready to turn 26, I was sitting in a treatment center, and I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. I had no friends. My family were done with me. I had lost numerous jobs, sold cars for crack. I mean, it was just, the list was endless. And I did what they told me to do in the very beginning. They said, get a sponsor and go to meetings. And that's absolutely what I did. And, you know, I'm a pretty tough woman. I knew I had to have a tough sponsor. Found this woman who knew the book inside and out. I loved her. I loved listening to her meetings. Asked her to sponsor me. Sybil showed up, and it was downhill after that. She made me do the craziest of things. I mean, she made me go to meetings. She'd make me call her. I remember I called her one time. She told me never to call after 10 o'clock unless it was emergency. It was midnight. I was crying. That's an emergency. Called her. She said, what's wrong? I cried. I'm working on my four steps. She said, sounds like you're doing it right, and hung up. And I mean, I don't know where you all come from. I mean, I would not have been able to stay sober on baths, candles, and chocolate. I needed hardcore sponsorship. I needed somebody who cared more about my sobriety than she did my feelings. I needed somebody who wasn't afraid to tell me the truth and to tell me what to do. You know, I have a sponsor who says, wear a skirt behind the podium. And I'm like, that's so 50s. And I go, I have really nice pantsuits. And she says, well, you should find a sponsor that loves pantsuits as much as you do. And you know, I've been sober almost 24 years, and I really haven't changed much of anything from day one. I have a sponsor. I sponsor. I listen to my sponsor. I do what she tells me to do. I show up to AA. I get in the middle of the boat. I participate, and I try to share my experience, strength, and hope to the best of my ability. What I have to remember is that this is fun. This is the fun stuff. This is the icing. But I got to remember there's work to do. I got to remember that I have steps and a solution in my life that allow me to walk around in public and not duck behind end caps, that allow me to walk around and be comfortable in my own skin, because it's not just about the party. Because, see, I have a disease that wants me dead, and I better take care of that disease. I better treat that disease, and that means all four sides of the triangle, and that means I get to come have fun, but I have to do the work. I think it's hysterical that we come to the most spiritual weekend every 5 years, and more people leave with resentments than any other weekend ever. It cracks me up. And, you know, I'm not wound too tight anymore. I'm pretty laid-back, loosey-goosey person. And I just love to watch, sit back and watch the woundly tight people get upset. But I got to tell you, as a result of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and participating and becoming a member, what happened to me can happen to anyone. And, you know, it's kind of like preaching to the choir here. I loved the Australian guy last night when he said it's a commitment to travel 23 hours to get here. You know, shoot, I took a 2-hour flight. It was nice. Got some peanuts, and we didn't get service, though. Turbulence. You know, we were all upset. And then something like that happens. 23 hours in a plane with those people, I would die. So, anyway. So here's what happened. I worked the steps. I got a great life. I wish I could sit down. But see, I'm an alcoholic. I'm self-centered to the core. I do crazy things like call Passages Treatment Center and tell them they're a crock. I mean, I'd like to be able to tell you I did that like when I was a year. That was last year. I mean, that's why I need to be here. But I want to tell you a couple of things. Where am I at on time? I want to talk about a couple of things that have been more powerful to me in my sobriety than anything else. And that is, one, my relationship with my father was restored. And we were clean. And he decided to join AA. And we would celebrate our birthdays together because I had 10 more days than him. And he died about 8 years ago. And that is a loss that just will never heal. But I absolutely know that that man is proud of me today. I'm proud of the woman that I have become as a result of you people. But about a year before he got sick, he called me and he said, Joy, there's a little gal in Tulsa that's trying to get a hold of you. And I called this little gal. And it was the little gal that I had put up for adoption. And we started a relationship. And I went down to meet her. I had two kids at the time. My youngest was 6 months. And I don't know about her. I think it was awkward. It was weird. It was like, oh, what the hell are we doing? And but I was so happy on the inside. And one of my biggest regrets in life was if this moment ever happened, I would have to say that I didn't know who the father was. And she asked me about the father, her father. And I said, I go, here it is, the moment. I've thought about this crap forever. And I go, I don't know. I'm sorry, I don't know. And she said, what any pre-AA member would say, it's okay, these things happen. And, you know, I don't know, some time goes by, she calls me one day, and she's like, how do you know if you're an alcoholic? And I said, you're asking. And she tried to do the thing on her own, and she tried to go to AA, and she tried, you know, she did all this stuff, and it wasn't working. And she called me. We have a huge New Year's Eve party every year at our home. And I said, just come up here. Just drive up here. She came to my house with 7 days of sobriety. And she left on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. And she's sitting in the third row. How does that happen? I don't know how that happens other than walking through the door, believing that there's a higher power, and being willing to take some steps that I don't necessarily agree or believe in. That's the magic that happens here. I have a sister that when I went to make amends to her, she could care less. You know, all of my amends at that point had been brilliant. And I got to my sister and she could care less. I had no idea how much I had actually harmed her. And my sponsor just kept saying, call her every week. Just keep taking the action. And at one point I was like, I can't do this anymore, Barb. It's too painful. She doesn't want anything to do with me. I had found out a few years. It took 10 years, by the way, before I remember us truly connecting. And maybe we did before that, but I remember the moment. I was almost 10 years sober when I truly felt that her and I were connected again. See, I had no idea how much damage I had done to that little girl. I was out of the house. Us people who think our drinking doesn't harm anyone when we don't live at home, we're idiots. Because that little girl was living at home. She was in high school. And my mom was so depressed about me that she would lay in bed all day. And when my sister got home from school, she'd have to clean the house and start dinner and get my mom out of bed just so it looked like my mom had done something when my dad came home. That's what my drinking, not in the home, did to my family. And I got to tell you, where we're at today, that little girl is my best friend. She called me one day and she said, Joy. I go, yeah? I'm at the DMV. I'm like, why are you whispering? I'm at the DMV and I'm standing behind a guy on the phone who's talking to somebody and saying he has 30 days of sobriety, but he thinks he's going to drink. What should I do? And I said, well, I don't know. She goes, should I talk to him? I go, yes. I go, whatever you do, get his name and number. And she called me back, got his name and number, and I called the little guy. And I said, hey, my name's Joy. I think you just met my sister. And he said, yes, she almost ran me over in the parking lot. And spoken like a true newcomer, he said, I didn't know what she wanted. I thought she was trying to pick me up. And I'm like, yeah, she wants what you got in her Volvo with her kids in the back. Please. But that relationship has healed. And it was so painful doing the work to make that relationship heal. I am so grateful today that I get to belong to a group of crazy people that do not normally mix. And we get to come here and we get to help save lives. I take that line in the book about we have the power. Once we have the solution, we now have the power to avert death and misery for others. See, I take that line very, very seriously, which I'm probably talked about in my home group quite a bit when my back is turned. And because I'm hard. I don't mess around. Like, this isn't a game to me. Like, I've been to funerals. I've seen what the disease of alcoholism can do to people. I know what the funerals look like with the sobbing families. I was talking to my husband's boss yesterday, and I went and met his wife. We were at the Dome, and we were talking about it. And do you guys realize that every single one of these badges, every single one of these badges means one less broken family? And when you can put it into that kind of perspective, we have a responsibility here. Like, I don't get to come here and get the gifts and say, thanks, see ya. I have an obligation and a responsibility to stay here and to get in the middle and to show you how I've been able to change my life. And for somebody who walked in here without anything, and most of all, without a soul, to have what I have today. I have a great husband. We're going on 15 years of marriage. I have You can clap. Woo! 'Cause see, I'm not the type of person that stays committed like that. And he's not either. And we have these two awesome kids. I want to make sure I get to talk about them. I have a 13-year-old and a 9-year-old, and they love you people. They love Alcoholics Anonymous, especially my oldest, Brady. I mean, we have a little conference at home called the Sunflower Roundup, and he comes to it. He loves it. He knows what happens here. He knows that lives get saved here. He knows about steps. And I love this story. It's actually my husband's story, but he didn't get asked to share. So he had a fifth step to listen to, and a guy came over, and he went upstairs, and a couple minutes later came back down, and he left. And Brady was like, what happened? And Darren goes, he didn't do it right. So I don't know, a couple days later or something, another guy comes over to do a fifth step, goes upstairs, couple minutes later comes back down, and Brady goes, you didn't do it right, did you? And then I have this 9-year-old who is crazy. Crazy awesome, but crazy. And I just can't wait to see what these kids do with their lives. I always talk about this at my home group, and that I respect the men in our home group so very much, because my kids are around them and they're learning how to be men by watching the men in our home group. So I really put a lot of responsibility on the men at Nuts and Bolts, because you are shaping and forming the lives of these little kids. And like I said, Cooper's crazy. We were driving the other day. He's going into third grade. He just had his first communion. And he thinks he's all bad. And we were driving, and he goes, Mom, do you take the wine? And I go, no. And I don't want to argue with you afterwards about it's the blood of Christ. I'd like to see what happens to you on a gallon of blood of Christ. Anyway, he goes, because of that AA thing, and I go, yeah. And he goes, oh, man, I had 8 years till I took that wine. So, we have a family in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was reading the part in the 12 and 12 about satisfactions of right living and the obligations squarely met, and I'm not a round thing and a square thing, whatever it is. I'm not a big buck quoter, but that's absolutely true. I mean, we are in this together. And I think that's the one thing that I try to remember every single day, that no matter what, we are in this together. Good, bad, cute, ugly, whatever, mean, cranky, we are in this together. And we got to remember to have each other's backs. That's what gives me the satisfaction that I have in my life today, is knowing that I got you people behind me. And I want you to know that you've got me behind you. I am so grateful. I am so blessed. There are no words to show you that, other than the way that I walk through this program. I want to thank you for this opportunity. I am truly, truly humbled by it. I cannot even believe it. And I want to say thank you on behalf of the state of Kansas, because you know what? AA rocks in Kansas. Thanks.
Thank you, Joy, and thank you, Joy's cheering section. Next, we'll hear from Fred W. from Fargo, North Dakota.
Thanks. I'm Fred. I'm an alcoholic. I do reside in Fargo, but I'm originally from Minnesota, and I do happen to be a Twins fan, so I apologize. We talked about that earlier, but thanks for cheering me on anyway. transparency, right? Yeah, my sober date is April 14th, 2011. And my home group is the BYOBB group. It meets Monday night at 7:30. We study the big book and then we talk about it. We also have a weekly workshop that we go through the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts. And that's more of an open dialogue where we just kind of ask questions. And we're fortunate enough to have people that have served in Alcoholics Anonymous for quite some time. So we really get to tap into that experience. And I'm really grateful for that. So, be honest, I don't really know how to follow that. That was... just talk about how awesome Joy was. I'm a thinker. I don't know if anybody relates to that, but I like to think and I like to analyze. And so, you know, I got this email a couple months ago, and satisfaction of right living. And I'm thinking, well, obviously they asked me to talk about that, you know. And but how should we define satisfaction? You know, what really is right living? You know, it's good because that mindset of constantly seeking, I think, it can be a defect, but I think it's one of those things that when I allow my higher power to use that, I can continue to grow and develop. You know, it's a pretty awesome thing. I mean, people we obsess and spin ourselves nuts, but if we have some direction with that, look out, you know what I mean? anyway, what I came up with, I guess, for the satisfaction part was they were talking a lot about the mindset of it, you know, feeling content or whatever. There's also that emotional aspect of it too. So I thought it would be good to talk about the dissatisfaction of Fred's way of life before this. yeah, not very clever. I also had a normal childhood. I was really active in sports. My mom was a teacher. My parents split up when I was pretty young, but it seemed normal to me because it was all I knew. I ended up having a couple of sets of parents, which was pretty awesome. You know, I could lie and manipulate to four people instead of two. So, I had a great childhood. I was happy. I was kind of the class clown guy. I loved making people laugh, and I seemed to fit in wherever I went. And I was, pretty good athlete and was captain of the football team, played baseball, stuff like that. And it just seemed like there was a couple of critical times in my life where I kind of faced the fork in the road, if you will. And the first one was... you know, we were just doing normal binge drinking stuff, right? You know, like getting a case of beer and just driving around because that's what we did, you know? I mean, this is when I was in high school, but we were at a party one night and, you know, like I said, driving drunk was like a hobby, you know? So we're going from one party to the next and, it's 2-3 in the morning. There's nobody on the road and there was a carload, myself, two other males in the car with me. And then there was two females in the car behind us following us. And long story short, they ended up getting into a wreck, and one of the girls died. And we turned around, you know, ditched our beers, turned around. We were the first ones on the scene of the accident. And I had an opportunity to see to see firsthand what was going on within me, you know, like what that disease can do. I will never, ever forget that. But 6 months later, I got arrested for DUI. that was the first crossroad, right? Because I start to feel guilty about this stuff. And it's not my fault. It's God's fault, you know? Like, it should have been me. That was kind of the mentality. And then it just turned into kind of this thing of go as hard as I could, really hate myself, go as hard as I could, really hate myself, go as hard as I could. You know, really trying to, like it says in the book, blot out those, whatever, you know, the intolerable situation, I don't know, whatever it is. But basically, you know, just like trying to just forget any experience that I was having, you know, because it sucked. And I guess it turned into this situation where, again, you know, I like to analyze things, but I was so fed up with reality that I started to create this alternate reality where, thanks. It's fun out there, trust me. But I just started to, I mean, basically, like it talks about in the book, I just started to create this other universe where I was the center of everything, you know, and it got really crazy really fast. I found myself in AA after that first DUI, and I, you know, didn't go through the book. I got a sponsor because I had to get out of treatment, and the only reason I went to treatment is because my lawyer told me to look good for the judge. You know, I had the little call at home monitor. I had to say Canada and Colorado and whatever, the voice recognition breathalyzer system, you know. But I just, it didn't, like, I was above it. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't, and granted, you know, like, I've seen a good friend dead in a car, but I'm above whatever's going on, you know. Pretty insane already at that point, but I went to AA. I stayed sober for about 18 months. And really, you know, it was just, like I said, I was above everything, you know. I had it figured out. Self-knowledge cured me, you know. Which, you know, crazy enough, after, fast forward a little while, meet with a sponsor going through the big book, and they talk about that story, Fred, in the big book, and how he's the self-knowledge guy, right? Anyway, right, so it started to become like this quest of self-knowledge, you know, like I started, I don't want to say that I started reading a bunch of religious texts because I didn't really read any of the books that I got. I just basically started to collect leather-bound books and then brag about them, you know. But after, you know, after the 18 months, I started drinking again, and it started off as, oh, I'm just going to smoke pot, you know, it's natural and whatever. And, you know, it was just on the weekends because I was going to be the sober driver and just get high, you know. you know, it was maybe a month or two into it. It was just right back to the all-day, everyday sort of mentality. And if it wasn't booze, it was, you know, getting stoned as soon as I woke up. And then kind of managing a little bit throughout my life, just trying to kind of coast along. And then as soon as responsibility was off my shoulders, it was as hard as I could, you know. I was in school. That was one of the things that came with that 18 months of sobriety, is getting back into school and studying psychology, you know, drugs and behavior and all this stuff. And just, you know, trying to suck in as much as I could. And I just really think about it. When I look back on it, I really think about, you know, when people talk about having that hole, you know, that you're just trying to cram as much stuff into as you can, and it just never seems to get filled, you know. Again, just fast forward a little bit. I graduated because there was some people at the college that I was going to that were just wonderful to me. You know, went above and beyond to see that I was able to walk the line, which I didn't show up to, but I got a diploma later on. So, you know, then it was like, okay, now everything's supposed to be good, right? I have a college degree. You know, I should be, like, things should be working out, but I just remember feeling like I was always looking forward for something to, like, come along and fix what was going on, or just something that would give me some sort of a foundation to stand on, you know. Like, I just remember feeling like, I mean, Minnesota ice fishing, I guess, you know, like, constantly feeling like you're on thin ice, and it's just like you can hear the, it cracking around you, and it's like, I don't really want to pay attention to it, but I know what's going on, you know? Another evening out, I offered to escort a woman home, and she told me that if that was going to be the case, I had to drive her car. You know, at this time, I'm really managing my drinking. I'm telling everyone around me not to let me drive their car. I'm only bringing $20 with me to the bar and an ID, but still managing to black out all the time. And so she said, if you want, if this is going to happen, you have to drive my car. I ran a red light, got another DUI, and found myself in jail again, and really questioning existence, you know, questioning who I was in the big scheme of things. At this time, I had really, really jumped into that. A professional told me it's called temporary psychosis or something like that. So it's like the radio was talking to me. I'd look at a billboard and it was a sign, and that would lead to this thing, and that would lead to this thing. And it was very deep and meaningful to me at the time, you know. But again, you know, it was just constantly this thing of just like, I'm always chasing after something, you know, never really feeling satisfied, never really looking at a situation and saying, you know, that looks good. You know, there was always something wrong, always something that I could change or do better, you know. So I got an assessment with a guy that I had taken a class with. I figured, hey, this is good. I know him, you know. And he looked at me, we had a little talk, and he looked at me and he said, what do you want me to write down, you know, because the judge had court-ordered this. And for the first time in my, well, first time that I can remember, I was honest about my drinking, and I just said, I don't know, you know. At that point, I had exhausted everything that I could think of, every action, everything that I could do. I didn't know. So I did some outpatient treatment, and he told me to start going back to AA. And when I went back to AA, I was terrified. I wanted you guys to really like me. I wanted to sound as smart as I thought I was, which was not possible. But so early on, I don't really know, but in my mind, I didn't really say much, you know. The first couple of meetings that I went to, there was just this core of people that were just doing, you know, like, I don't know. They were running around, they were laughing, they were having a good time, and it just sucked me in, you know. A guy offered to give me a ride to a meeting, and he asked me if I wanted a sponsor. So I started going through the book with him and stuff. And, you know, I know that we've all kind of done that, but I guess the big thing that I want to share about what it's like now is just the more that I study Alcoholics Anonymous and the more that I do as a result of what I've learned or read about, the more satisfied I feel. I've had an opportunity in the last year to do some PI, CPC work. And again, you know, touching back on those people that are in our home group and have that experience, you know, being able to talk to them. And, you know, I had this lady call me from the radio. She wanted to do a piece on anonymity. And the guy goes, oh, read page 106 in The Grapevine, or the Language of the Heart, you know. And I'm like, well, okay, and I flip it open, anonymity. It's like, how the hell does he remember that, you know? but you know, it's just, yeah. But, you know, having those conversations and being able to be responsible and to be accountable, you know, those things were things that I always thought that I exemplified, you know. It's like, I'm Mr. Honesty, you know, like, and whatever. But I didn't even know what those things meant because I had no experience with them. All I knew is that I expected everything and I did nothing, you know. Or that's what I found out anyway, you know. I was told that honesty is the total absence of any intent to deceive. and I knew that I had never been honest in my life, you know. I was told that I needed to mean what I say and to do what I say I'm going to do. And that was really difficult. It still is, to be honest with you, at times, because I want to do everything, and I can't. But I had an opportunity to get involved in a career that I absolutely love. I got a master's degree. I was working full-time, going to school full-time, and doing AA full-time. And that's not something that I ever thought that I could accomplish, you know, but I had tons of people around me that supported me the entire time, and they said, just keep going, you know, that's all you have to do. I want to stop and look around and say, well, this isn't right, and that, what's going to happen down there? What, you know, like, just flip out. It's like, just keep going, you know. But, you know, like I said, I have an opportunity today to work with a different section of God's kids, and I can't tell you how satisfying that is. I have always, always wanted a purpose. And I thought, you know, AA was going to be the purpose. And, you know, to be honest with you, I was okay with that if it just meant helping other drunks. But there, I've found so much more beyond the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because of what you guys have taught me. That satisfaction that I've always wanted is limitless. You know, my sponsor always tells me there's as much in front of me today as there was the day that I came in. A life without end, you know. And I'm grateful for that. The other thing that I wanted to just briefly talk about is I, too, have family members that are struggling, and I have people around me that can tell me how to act, or they show me how to act, so that I don't have to try to, you know, be the big book thumper guy or whatever, you know. Or I don't even know if that what I'm trying to say, but like my dad, he struggles. He's not doing well, and I had an opportunity a couple months ago to just sit down with him and just say, look, the way that you're living, it terrifies me, you know. And I don't, I'm not trying to tell you how to live, but I want to be a part of your life, you know. That's not me. That's what you guys have taught me. You know, me is, Dad, you're going to die if you don't quit drinking, get in the frickin' car, you know what I mean? Like, but it's different because it's family, you know, and maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, but it, our relationship today is phenomenal, you know. He tells me how thankful he is and how proud of me he is, you know. And if nothing else, that is extremely satisfying, you know. So I don't know. I too have just been really humbled by this whole experience. I mean, it's one thing to hear or to read that AA is worldwide, but to see it, you know, like that flag ceremony last night. I know we were chuckling a lot about people's ability to wave the flags, but. I still judge. I forget the one guy with the cast. He was dancing. That was my favorite. But anyway, but it's humbling. You know, it's extremely humbling. And there was a time when I was new that we went to Jamestown, which is you guys. It's a ways away from Fargo. But anyway. This guy told me, he was one of those guys that was like a circuit speaker guy or whatever, so I like idolized him, you know. And he's like, I'll tell you, key to serenity, humility. I'm like, oh my God, this is, you know, but it was one of the, it was one of those things that, like, it was like he had made a shovel out of those words and just smacked me over the head with it, you know. It's like, like I can't, and it's stuck with me ever since that. And you know, to me, the essence of the satisfaction I get is my ability to be humble. Which, again, as my sponsor has told me time and time again, is it's not thinking less of me; it's thinking of me less. You know, thinking about other people. So I want to just thank everybody from Fargo for showing up here and being supportive. Not that you came to this for me, but you know what I mean. So thanks for listening.
Thank you, Fred. Next, we're going to hear from Mickey H. from Utah Springville.
Hi, everybody. My name is Mickey, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am from Springville, Utah. My home group is the Sisters in Sobriety group in Springville. Yoo-hoo! And my sobriety date is September 10th, 1963. Now that we got all that stuff out of the way, I can tell you I am so glad to be here. But, you know, they asked me when I came up here which order we wanted to speak in. And the way we were listed on the program was Joy and then Fred and then me, and I said, well, that's fine. You know, I'll go last. I was thinking maybe they'll take up most of the time, you know. And now I wish I'd gone first, because how do you follow that, you know? I am just really grateful to have the opportunity to share in any Alcoholics Anonymous meeting anywhere, anytime. I am so humbled by just the idea that someone is willing to sit and listen to me. I did not come into Alcoholics Anonymous real tightly wrapped. When I came here, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I thought I was just nuts, you know? And I thought that alcohol was the solution to my problem. Because the only time I felt okay was when I was loaded. I went through my whole life prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous never feeling like I fit or belonged any place in the world. I didn't fit in my family. I didn't fit in the little town where I grew up. I didn't fit in the church I went to. I didn't fit in the schools I attended. I just didn't fit. I was like that, you know, that square peg in that round hole. It just didn't quite mash down. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not because I wanted to, or because I knew I had a problem. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because somebody else knew I had a problem. And it's not unusual that somebody might know that we have a problem, but the person who knew that I had a problem was locked up in a state mental institution in the state of California. And he came home on leave, and this was a man I had met but didn't really know very well. And I knew that he was not locked up for being an alcoholic. He was locked up for being crazy and beating up women. And he showed up and he told me we were going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now at the time, it doesn't make a lot of sense, even looking back, that I would get in a car with this guy and go someplace where I didn't know where I was going or how I was going to get back. But it's probably the best choice I ever made in my life. Up to that point, I had not made real good choices. I was at the time that he took me to that first meeting, I was living on Skid Row in Los Angeles. I was homeless. I was unemployed and unemployable. And I had wine sores all over my arms and my legs, and I weighed 85 pounds. And I was dying of the disease of alcoholism, and I didn't know I had it. No one had ever told me that I was an alcoholic before. I want to back up just a little bit and tell you that I was not like these guys. I did not grow up in a normal family. I grew up in an alcoholic family. My mother, God love her, was an untreated Al-Anon. She needed Al-Anon desperately but never got here. She kept marrying alcoholics. She married my father, and when I was 2 years old, she divorced him because he beat us up and threw us out in the middle of a snowstorm. And then she turned right around and married another alcoholic who was even worse. And so my childhood was not what you'd call idyllic. My father was the town drunk. And pretty soon I was joining him. I started drinking when I was 11 years old. I remember my first drunk. No, I take that back. I don't remember my first drunk. I remember the beginning of my first drunk. I went to a midnight movie on Halloween with a bunch of other kids from the junior high school that I was attending. And I was 11 years old. And one of the boys had a father who made homebrew, so he brought a jug of homebrew to the movie. And all of us tasted it, and he and I were the only ones that liked it, so we finished it off. I don't remember how I got home that night. I was told later that I got kicked out of that midnight horror movie on Halloween for causing a disturbance. I'm not sure how you do that. I was in a lot of trouble with my parents because I had been escorted home in really pretty bad shape, I guess. And you would think if the very first time that you got drunk, you got in a lot of trouble and you didn't remember what happened and you were sick as a dog the next day, you might think twice about doing it again. And I did it the first chance I got and every chance thereafter. By the time I came to the program, I had been married twice and was in the process of being divorced by my second husband. I had traveled around the United States. I figured out one time that in 2 years I hit 18 states. I used to tell myself that I liked change. The truth was I used to have blackouts and I would get drunk in one state and come to in another one and not know how I got there. I had been in and out of hospitals. And you know, it's funny because nobody ever told me that I had alcoholism when I was in the hospital. They told me I had malnutrition. They told me I had chronic anemia. They told me I had pneumonia. They told me I had, I love this, unexplained fainting spells. Nobody ever told me those were all symptoms of alcoholism. And then when I started getting locked up in jails, it wasn't because I was an alcoholic. It wasn't because I was drunk. I never had a DUI. I was kind of proud of that until somebody pointed out that it's hard to get a DUI when you've never had a driver's license or owned a car. But I got locked up for stupid stuff. Disturbing the peace, disorderly conduct. My favorite was inciting a riot. But I didn't know that I was an alcoholic. I thought that I was a victim of circumstances and poor companions. My mother told me so. She was a good candidate for Al-Anon, like I said. When I came to that first meeting, I am very grateful somebody had told that man about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he took me to that meeting, and I never saw him again after that meeting. But I found something in that meeting. And what I found, I didn't know what it was, but I found an enthusiastic group of young people who were staying sober and having a good time doing it. And this group down here, that with their enthusiasm, they kind of remind me of my first home group, because that's what my first home group was. We cheered each other on, and we were there for each other. And we did a lot of traveling around to other groups and sharing with other people in the program. And it became a wonderful introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous for me. I figured out after I'd been around for... pretty soon, you know, within the first couple of meetings, I figured out the way you get accepted around here is to say you're an alcoholic. So I said I was an alcoholic, even though I didn't really believe it. And then after I'd been sober about 6 months, it hit me, oh, I'm an alcoholic. And it was okay, because by that time, I'd been around long enough that I had some tools that I knew what to do about it. And they told me, okay, you know you're an alcoholic. It's time to start working the steps. And I tried. I really tried to work the steps. And I stumbled a lot. If there was a wrong way to do it, I found it. And I thought that if I didn't do it perfectly, it wasn't going to work. I need to tell you, you don't have to do it perfectly. You only need to do it to the best of your ability. And sometimes that ability can be piss poor, and you can still stay sober. And now I need to get around to the topic. I stayed sober, and I got real involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got involved in service in the H&I committees in Southern California. And I spent the next 28 years bouncing in and out of jails and hospitals and institutions like I had a rubber band on me, you know, in and out to every place that I could get in and trying to carry the message to the best of my ability. And I thought I had found my niche in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was going to spend the rest of my life carrying the message into institutions because somebody had carried the message into that institution to that man who brought me to my first meeting. And I was so grateful for that. And I never thought that I would get involved in any other form of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I moved to Utah. And I found out that they do things differently in Utah than they do in California. And all of the hospital and institutional work is done through the general service structure. So it became necessary for me to become a little more open-minded. See, I used to think those people in general service talked and talked and talked and talked while the people in H&I did the work. And I found out that that's just not true. I found out that I had contempt prior to investigation. And I had to open my mind and be willing to become involved in the general service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I had had some great rewards already. You know, those satisfactions of right living just by doing what I had been doing. I have lifelong friends that I met inside of institutions who got sober and got out and are still sober today. And that I love them dearly. And I stayed sober. That's the main thing. I stayed sober regardless of what was going on in my life. Now, I managed to get married in AA. And I was married for several years, and I had a couple of children. And I was very grateful I didn't have any children before I came to AA because I thought that I would have screwed them up. But I had a couple of children in AA and found out you can screw them up just as bad sober. I was not a very good parent. I admit it. I'm just not a very good parent. Don't have those skills. But I had those two children, and then I got divorced. And in my 13th year of sobriety, I got married again, and I married a man who had four children. And so here we are with six kids, and neither one of us knows what to do with them. But I got to tell you that five of those six children turned out to be alcoholics and got sober in this program. And that sixth child goes to Al-Anon. I don't understand it. I don't know where we went wrong. But I'm absolutely convinced she's not an alcoholic. I went to visit her in 2002, and I opened her refrigerator to get something out of the refrigerator, and there was a bottle of champagne in there. And I said, Lisa, are you going to celebrate something? And she said, no, what do you mean? I said, well, there's a bottle of champagne in your fridge. And she said, oh, somebody gave me that to celebrate the new millennium, and I forgot it was there. 2 years it had been in the fridge. So I'm pretty sure she's in the right program. You know, I've had great satisfactions in the program by doing service work in the program, by carrying the message to other alcoholics. I was given the great privilege of representing the Utah area as a delegate a few years ago, and that was just absolutely an amazing experience. But as I was thinking about what were the satisfactions of right living that I wanted to share with you, I thought about all the great experiences I've had, the opportunities we've had to travel and visit AA all over the world. And yeah, that's a great thing, and that is a satisfaction of right living. Those are experiences I would not have had if I hadn't stayed sober and tried to work this program. But you know that those aren't the greatest satisfactions of right living that I found. The greatest satisfactions of right living that I found are those times that I've been able to be there for someone, another alcoholic, whether it's a member of my family or a member of the fellowship or just somebody out there in the street that needs us and is stumbling along drunk today. You know, the satisfactions that I get that are the best satisfactions of right living are the satisfaction I'm able to get when I'm able to carry the message to someone who desperately needs it like I did and doesn't know that they have a problem or doesn't know what their problem is. You know, and it's easy for us sometimes to think that everybody now comes through the courts or comes through the treatment centers or, hey, I got to tell you, there are still a lot of drunks out there on the street that don't know about us and who will never go to a treatment center because they have no way to get to a treatment center. They have no insurance. They have no money. They have no job. They have nobody like me. They're like me. They're those drunks living on Skid Row who have no resources to get here unless we bring them here. And that's where I find my greatest satisfaction is when I'm able to carry the message to someone who has no other means to get here. And I also had some great satisfactions that, you know, it'll seem maybe strange to some of you, but of our six children, we had a daughter who got sober in the program, Susie. And Susie was sober 10 years, and she developed a brain tumor. And she was diagnosed with incurable brain cancer. And when she had 15 years of sobriety, she died. And, you know, I attended a couple's retreat a couple of years before she died. And during a meditation that was held at this couple's retreat, I had a spiritual experience that just absolutely was the most spiritual experience I have ever had in my life. And when my daughter was dying, I was able to lay in bed with her and share that experience with her. And I was able to tell her about this experience, which involved walking toward a rainbow and walking toward the light and then walking into the light and then becoming part of the light. And feeling that I was a part of everything and that everything was a part of me. And this may not, no one here may even relate to this because it's something that's so personal to me. But I was able to share that with my daughter when she was dying. And she was able to turn to me and say, and I'm going to be part of the light too. That's a satisfaction of right living. Knowing that I was there and able to give my daughter comfort when she was dying. And shortly after she died, our son was diagnosed with brain cancer also. And my husband was able to go over to Sacramento where our son lived and spend the last year of our son's life nursing him and caring for him. And I was able to stay home and keep the home fires burning and maintain our life financially and make that possible. You know, those are the satisfactions of right living. Those times when we can be there for the people we love and the people who love us. And our son had 15 years of sobriety and he died. And you know, my husband had the opportunity to share this story at the last international convention. He was able to speak and share this story just months after our son had died. And it's just, it's amazing because even though we lost two children that we love dearly, we know that they found this program and that they found a higher power here that enabled them to die with grace and dignity and in sobriety. And you know, I can't think of a better goal for my life than to be able to die sober with grace and dignity. I just can't think of anything that would be better. You know, I've had the opportunity to travel to meetings all over the world and to meet people in sobriety all over the world. It's amazing. Every country we go to, AA is there waiting for us. When I consider that when I was born, AA was only 7 years old. And it was only in the United States and very limited amount in Canada. And by the time I came to the program, AA was everywhere and everyone knew about it. And now by the time I'm able to come and share at an international convention, we had 96 flags on the floor last night. I mean, it is absolutely... absolutely mind-blowing to me that I was a little girl growing up in a very small town in Utah, but I don't remember a time when I didn't know that there was a place called Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I didn't know that Alcoholics Anonymous worked for people who had alcoholism. I have known that all of my life, and I think that is absolutely mind-boggling because Alcoholics Anonymous was so new, and yet already it had reached a small town in Utah. And I want to say that I am so grateful to know that Alcoholics Anonymous was here for me, and Alcoholics Anonymous was here for my children. Our children now range from 30 years to 60 days of sobriety. And I am so grateful for that. But I know, too, that I have grandchildren who need this program. I have grandchildren today who are drinking alcoholically. One of my grandchildren came to stay with us a short time ago and spent a few weeks with us. He was going to spend a few months with us and get on his feet, get sober and get on his feet. Within 3 weeks, he had gotten drunk and gotten loaded and brought drugs and a drug dealer into our house, and we had to kick him out. And I pray that Alcoholics Anonymous will still be here when that grandson is ready and when my other grandchildren are ready. We have an 8-year-old that we're saving a seat for. She's already demonstrating self-will run riot. But I would love to believe that Alcoholics Anonymous will be here for her and for her children and for her grandchildren. And I know that the only way that will happen is if we safeguard this fellowship and we preserve it in full strength for those that are yet to come. For those alcoholics like me that are stumbling around out there on Skid Row and don't have a way to get here. And for those alcoholics who are yet to be born and who are going to need us in the future. Because this disease isn't going away. You know, this disease isn't going away. And I hope this program isn't going away either. And I know that each of us here is responsible for that, for making sure that this program is still here for the next alcoholic generation that needs it. And, you know, if I could stand here and say that I am sure that Alcoholics Anonymous will be here for as long as it is needed, and as it says in the 12th tradition, for as long as God, excuse me, I'm sorry, as long as God needs us, then I am sure that Alcoholics Anonymous will be there. And I am so grateful for that. And that is a satisfaction of right living, knowing that I can have confidence that God is working through, not just through me, but through each one of you to make sure that happens. And thank you.
Thank you, Mickey. One of the things I love about this program is how we all come from such diverse backgrounds, but we come together and we relate and we support each other with this common malady we have, alcoholism, and I love it. Let's have another round for the speakers.